Okay, I'm going to cheat and start a little early, but I think most people are here. I would like to read you an extended passage, which of course I should have figured that would already have been read, but since Dr. Kraft read short snippets of it in his sort of survey of the whole thing, let him take a little bit of time and read through the longer passage. And then I'm just going to jump in, and hopefully you will be able to process why I read this by the time you're driving home. Maybe it'll be a question. I don't know. So this is the middle of the book, more or less. This is, Dr. Kraft said it was the, I believe he said it was the darkest chapter, darkest section of the text. And when he said that, I knew what he was talking about. I said, oh, it's got to be this. So you'll recognize it here. It shouldn't take very long. But I'm going to read the whole thing. It should only take half an hour. Maybe 7 minutes, I hope. I went to the fort about a long bow shot from Grum. My heart was still as ice, heavy as lead, cold as earth. But I was free now from all doubting and deliberating. I set my foot on the first stone of the crossing and called Psyche's name. She must have been very close, for almost at once I saw her coming down to the bank. We might have been two images of love, the happy and the stern. She so young, so bright-faced, joy in her eye and limbs, I burdened and resolute, bringing pain in my hand. So I spoke truly, Maya, she said, as soon as I had crossed the water and we had embraced. The king has been no hindrance to you, has he? Salute me for a prophetess. This startled me for a moment, for I had forgotten her foretelling, but I put it aside to be thought of later. Now I had my work to do. I must not, now of all times, begin doubting and pondering again. She brought me a little way from the water, I don't know into what part of her phantom palace, and we sat down. I threw back my hood and put off my veil and sat down the urn beside me. Oh, Oriole, said Psyche, what a storm cloud in your face. That's how you looked when you were most angry with me as a child. Was I ever angry? Ah, Psyche, do you think I ever scolded or denied you without grieving my heart 10 times more than yours? Sister, she responds, I meant to find no fault with you. Then find no fault with me today either, for indeed we must talk very gravely. Now listen, Psyche. Our father is no father. Your mother, peace upon her, is dead, and you have never been her kindred. I have been. I have tried to be, and still I must be, all the father and mother and kin you have, and all the king, too. Maya, you have been all this and more since the day I was born. You and the dear fox are all I ever had. Yes, the fox. I'll have something to say of him, too. And so, Psyche, if anyone is to care for you, or counsel you, or shield you, or if anyone is to tell you what belongs to the honor of our blood, it can be only I. But why are you saying all of this, Oriol? You do not think I have left off loving you because I now have a husband to love as well? If you would understand it, that makes me love you. Why, it makes me love everyone and everything more. This made me shudder, but I hid it and went on. I know you love me, Psyche, said I, and I think I should not live if you didn't, but you must trust me too. She said nothing, and now I was right on top of the terrible thing, and it almost struck me dumb. I cast about for ways to begin it. You spoke last time, I said, of the day we got the thorn out of your hand. We hurt you that time, Psyche, but we did right. Those who love must hurt. I must hurt you again today. And Psyche, you are still little more than a child. You cannot go your own way. You will let me rule and guide you. Or you all, I have a husband to guide me now. It was difficult not to be angered or terrified by her harping on it. I bit my lip, then said, Alas, child, it is about that very husband, as you call him, that I must grieve you. I looked straight at her eyes and said sharply, Who is he? What is he? A god, she said, low and quivering, and I think the god of the mountain. Alas, Psyche, you are deceived. If you knew the truth, you would die rather than lie in his bed. The truth? We must face it, child. Be very brave. Let me pull out this thorn. What sort of God would he be who dares not show his face? Dares not. You come nearer to making me angry, Oriol. But think, Psyche. Nothing that's beautiful hides its face. Nothing that's honest hides its name. No, no. Listen. In your heart, you must see the truth, however you tried to brazen it out with words. Think. Whose bride were you called? The brute's. And think again. If it's not the brute, who else dwells in these mountains? Thieves and murderers. Men worse than brutes and lecherous as goats, we may be sure. Are you a prize they'd let pass if you fell in their way? There's your lover, child. Either a monster, shadow and monster in one, maybe, a ghostly undead thing, or a salt villain whose lips, even on your feet or the hem of your robe, would be a stain to our blood. She was silent a long time, her eyes on her lap. And so, Psyche, I began at last, tenderly as I could, but she tossed away the hand that I had laid on hers. You mistake me, Oriol. If I am pale, it is with anger. There, sister, I have conquered it. I'll forgive you. You mean, I'll believe you mean nothing but good. Yet how or why you can have blackened and tormented your soul with such thoughts, but no more of that. If ever you loved me, put them away now. Blackened my thoughts? Well, they're not only mine. Tell me, Psyche, who are the two wisest men we know? Why, the fox, for one. For the second, I know so few. I suppose Bardia is wise in his own way. You said yourself that night in the five-walled room that he was a prudent man. Now, Psyche, these two, so wise and so different, are both agreed with each other and with me concerning this lover of yours. Agreed without doubt. All three of us are certain, either shadow brute or felon. You have told them my story, Oriol? It was ill done. I gave you no leave. My lord gave no leave. Oh, Oriol, it was more like Banta than you. I could not help it if my face reddened with anger, but I would not be turned aside. Doubtless, I said, there is no end to the secrecy of this. This husband, as you call him. Child, has his vile love so turned your brain that you can't see the plainest thing? A god? Yet on your own showing he hides and slinks and whispers, mum, and keep counsel, and don't betray me like a runaway slave. I am not certain that she had listened to this. What she said was, the fox, too. That is very strange. I never thought he would have believed in the brute at all. I had not said he did. But if that was what she took out of my words, I thought it no part of my duty to set her right. It was an error helping her towards the main truth. I had need of all help to drive her thither. Neither he nor I nor Bardia, said I, believes for one moment in your fancy that it is the god, no more than this wild heath is a palace. And be sure, Psyche, that if we could ask every man and woman in Glome, all would say the same. The truth is too clear. But what is all this to me? How should they know? I am his wife. I know. How can you know if you've never seen him? Oriol, how can you be so simple? How could I not know? But how, Psyche? What am I to answer to such a question? It's not fitting. It is especially to you, sister, who are a virgin. That matronly primness from the child she was went near to ending my patience. It was almost, but I think now she did not mean it so, as if she taunted me. Yet I ruled myself. Well, if you are so pure, Psyche, you will not refuse to put it to the test. What test, though I need none myself? I have brought a lamp and oil. See, here they are. I set them down beside her. Wait till he or it sleeps, then look. I cannot do that. Ah, you see. You will abide no test. And why? Because you are not sure yourself. If you were, you'd be eager to do it. If he is, as you say, a god, one glimpse will set all our doubts at rest. what you call our dark thoughts will be put to flight. The reason I can't... sorry, but you aren't. You daren't. Oh, Oriole, what evil you think. The reason I cannot look at him, least of all by such trickery as you'd have me do, is that he has forbidden me. I can think, and Bardia and the fox can think, of one reason only for such a forbidding, and of one only for your obeying it. Then you know little of love. You fling my virginity in my face again, do you? Better it than the sty you're in, so be it. Of what you now call love, I do know nothing. You can whisper about it to Redivil better than to me, or to Ungit's girls, maybe, or to the king's doxies. I know another sort of love. You shall find what it's like. You shall not, Oriole, Oriole. You are raving, said Psyche, herself unangered, gazing at me large-eyed, sorrowful, but nothing humble about her sorrow. You would have thought she was my mother, not I, almost hers. I had known this long time, that the old, meek, biddable Psyche was gone forever. Yet it shocked me afresh. Yes, I said, I was raving. You had made me angry. But I had thought, you will set me right, I don't doubt if I am mistaken, that all loves alike were eager to clear the thing they loved of vile charges brought against it, if they could. Tell a mother her child is hideous. If it's beautiful, she'll show it. No forbidding would stop her. If she keeps it hidden, the charge is true. You're afraid of the test, Psyche. I am afraid. No, I am ashamed to disobey him. Then even at best, look what you make of him, something worse than our father. Who that loved you could be angry at your breaking so unreasonable a command, and for so good a reason? Foolishness, Oriole, she answered, shaking her head. He is a god. He has good grounds for what he does, be sure. How should I know of them? I am only his simple Psyche. Then you will do it. Then you will not do it. You think, you say you think, that you can prove him a god and set me free from the fears that sicken my heart, but you will not do it. I would if I could, Oriole. I looked about me. The sun was almost setting behind the saddle. In a little while, she would send me away. I rose up. An end of this must be made, I said. You shall do it, Psyche. I command you. Dear Maya, my duty is no longer to you. Then my life shall end with it, said I. I flung back my cloak further, thrust out my bare left arm, and struck the dagger into it till the point pricked out on the other side. Pulling the iron back through the wound was the worst pain. But I can hardly believe how little I felt it. Oriole, are you mad? Cried Psyche, leaping up. You'll find linen in that urn. Tie up my wound, said I, sitting down and holding my arm out to let the blood fall on the heather. I had thought she might scream and wring her hands or faint, but I was deceived. She was pale enough, but had all her wits about her. She bound my arm. The blood came seeping through fold after fold, but she staunched it in the end. The bandaging could not be done in a moment. The sun was lower and the air colder when we were able to talk again. Maya, said Psyche, why did you do that? Or what did you do that for? To show you I'm an earnest girl. Listen, you have driven me to desperate courses. I give you your choice. Swear on this edge, with my blood still wet on it, that you will this very night do as I have commanded you, or else I'll first kill you and then myself. Oriole, she said, very queen-like, raising her head, you might have spared that threat of killing me. All your power over me lies in the other. Then swear, girl. You never knew me break my word. The look in her face now was one I did not understand. I think a lover, I mean a man who loved, might look so on a woman who had been false to him. And at last she said, you are indeed teaching me about kinds of love I did not know. It is like looking into a deep pit. I am not sure whether I like your kind better than hatred. Oh, Oriole, take my love for you because you know it goes down to my very roots. To take my love for you because you know it goes down to my very roots and cannot be diminished by any other newer love. And then to make of it a tool, a weapon, a thing of policy and mastery, an instrument of torture, I begin to think I never knew you. Whatever comes after, something that was between us dies here. Enough of your subtleties, said I. Both of us die here in the plainest truth and blood unless you swear. If I do, she said hotly, it will be not for any doubt of my husband or his love. It will only be because I think better of him than of you. He cannot be cruel like you. I'll not believe it. He will know how I was tortured into my disobedience. He will forgive me. He need never know, said I. The look of scorn she gave me flayed my soul. And yet this very nobleness in her, had I not taught it to her? What was there in her that was not my work? And now she used it to look at me as if I were base beneath all baseness. You thought I would hide it? Thought I would not tell him, she said, each word like a rubbing of a file across raw flesh. Well, it's all of a piece. Let us, as you say, make an end. You grow more and more a stranger to me at each word. And I had loved you so, loved, honored, trusted, and, while it was fit, obeyed. And now, but I can't have your blood on my threshold. You choose your threat well. I'll swear. Where's your dagger? So I had won my victory, and my heart was in torment. I had a terrible longing to unsay all my words and beg her forgiveness, but I held out the dagger. The oath on edge, as we call it, is our strongest in gloam. And even now, said Psyche, I know what I do. I know that I am betraying the best of lovers, and that perhaps before sunrise all my happiness may be destroyed forever. This is the price you have put upon your life. Well, I must pay it. She took her oath. My tears burst out, and I tried to speak, but she turned her face away. The sun is almost down, she said. Go, you have saved your life. Go and live it as you can. I found I was becoming afraid of her. I made my way back to the stream, crossed it somehow, and the shadow of the saddle leapt across the whole valley as the sun set. What's the last time that you read... Till We Have Faces, if you've read it before. Has it been a while? Good, then I'm glad I read that. Sorry for those that just read it. Fascinating passage. Hopefully we'll have a little chance to get back to it. I'm going to move quickly through my material, hoping at the end we'll have a little bit of time to do some Q&A. So we're going to leave this behind. Hopefully it'll fit in later. Hope you enjoyed the read aloud. My dear Lucy, says C.S. Lewis, the preface to Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. I wrote this story for you, but when I began it, I had not realized that girls grow quicker than books. As a result, you are already too old for fairy tales, and by the time it is printed and bound, you will be older still. But someday, you will be old enough to start reading fairy tales again. You can then take it down from some upper shelf, dust it, and tell me what you think of it. Your affectionate godfather, C.S. Lewis. And then from Lewis's Weight of Glory, we get this admonition. Remember your fairy tales. Spells are used for breaking enchantment as well as for inducing them. And you and I have need of the strongest spell that can be found to wake us from the evil enchantment of worldliness which has been laid upon us for nearly 100 years. So, how do fairy tales, or fairy stories in general, help us to live the good life or to be better people? I'm going to suggest to you 3 ways. I think there's probably many more, but we'll come back to these 3 at the end. 1, by helping us to relate to the world the way God would have us relate to the world. 2, by helping us to understand how to know the world around us. And 3, by helping us to enter into the mysteries of creation and redemption. So I think fairy tales can do all 3 of those things and probably quite a bit more. If you've got ideas for more, let me know afterwards. I'd like to come back to those, as I said. For now, however, let's see if we can break into Lewis and Tolkien's ideas about fairy stories, or at least some of them. There's so much material that I just did process of narrowing and narrowing and narrowing, because there's so much out there. Firstly, let's look at what Lewis, in the quote above, you and I have need of the strongest spell that can be found to wake us from the evil enchantment of worldliness. What do you think he means by the word worldliness in that quote? And one of the things you'll find, and I'm sorry if it's confusing, you can ask questions afterwards, but there'll be lots of words that I think in a lot of the material I'm using get used in various different ways, and words that maybe we use today in slightly different ways. If it is confusing, ask questions. The last group seemed to do it okay, so if you don't, you know what that means. But I'm confused by it half the time, so seriously. But in a word, I think what Lewis really was talking about was rationalism. rationalizing the world around us. In a 1976 interview, which unfortunately is way before some of you were born, Clyde Kilby says this: Lewis saw the mistake that I think has been taking place for at least 100 years. This may seem radical to you, he says, but we believe that our rationalization is the source of truth. I think that abstraction is just fine, but reality does not subject itself to rationalization. Well, some better tell the world around us, because that's the way our world works. You know, he says reality does not subject itself to rationalization. Lewis says that the brain is the organ of truth, but the imagination is the organ of reality. Kilby goes on to point out that the Lord himself used the imaginative methods of communication. Story was a main tool for Jesus in his teaching, wasn't it? Even his preaching tended to be rather more poetical than discursive and academic. Poetry, metaphor, and myth are very much alike, says Kilby. They belong to the objective world, not to the rationalized world. And there we have maybe the first instance of something we probably use the word objective today, more in line with sort of the more rationalized idea. But Kilby, 40 years ago, wasn't seeing it that way. And so we've probably just gone further down this road to where it's even hard to talk about it. So poetry, metaphor, and myth are very much alike. They belong to the objective world, not to the rationalized. So there is a sense in which these guys would talk about the objective world that was not rationalistic. So the fight against the rationalized world, according to Kilby's read of Lewis, is the imagination. Robert Smith, in his book Patches of Godlight, The Pattern of Thought of C.S. Lewis, says that according to Lewis, though the imagination might entertain, that's fine, its noblest and most essential function was that of guiding the mind toward the higher truths that gave meaning to existence. When functioning as it should in secular as well as religious contexts, imagination is the most important means by which higher truths can be communicated. The most important means. That's not what I run into, generally, out there in the world today. But Lewis says that imagination is the most important means of communicating those higher truths. Smith continues, Lewis was concerned to dispel the popular notion that whatever is imaginative is by its very nature false or non-existent. What the ordinary person fails to conceive is that there are some aspects of reality that can be conveyed in no other way than imaginatively. Inasmuch as reality itself transcends the most abstract language, the imagination can offer, when properly focused, higher integrative levels, helping to lead the receptive mind toward a supraverbal apprehension of reality that draws upon the mind's innate capabilities of recognizing truth when presented with it. Naturally recognizing truth. Thus, by imagination, Lewis meant something far more important than the aesthetic experience of the fabrication of fantasies, as fun and entertaining as that might be. Ken Myers of AWI fame, who also happens to be an author and founder, producer of, and writer for, and interviewer for Mars Hill Audio Journal, says this of Lewis: For Lewis, Christianity is not some airy spiritual tale suspended in the minds of believers. Christianity is truth about reality. I like that. Truth about reality. In Lewis's view, reality is not a social construction, but something objectively out there, knowable by the human mind. In Christian terms, God's creation is ordered and rational. But, Lewis insisted, the reasonableness of creation does not mean that it can be fully or best known by analyzing it. Thus, Lewis opposed subjectivism, the idea that all value and truth is purely personal, and scientism, the belief that all truth worth the name has to be empirically verifiable and quantifiable. Myers interviewed Thomas Howard once on the subject of C.S. Lewis. On this topic of the imagination versus the rationalized perspective, if you will, let me share a snippet of that interview. We start with Howard, who is referencing Lewis's novel, Till We Have Faces. Quote, The wisdom of Greece, represented by a character called the fox, a slave and tutor of the young princesses, He is full of common sense and lovely maxims. On the other side, you have the old priest of Ungut with his beak-like mask, his stink of blood, and then lists off all these sort of pagan practice, religious stuff that he's getting, amulets, etc. And you become aware, says Howard, that he knows something the fox does not know. He is plunged much further into reality than the fox can ever dream of. Remember, I think Kresh said this, that our first sort of response to these guys is that the fox is on our side. We're on his side, right? And here again, you know, Howard's saying, oh no, you start to realize that the priest, he's just, there's more there. There's more going on in his experience than the fox has ever gotten close to. Myers responds with, at one point, the priest says something chiding the rationalism of the fox. He says, holy places are dark places. Holy wisdom is not clear and thin like water, but thick and dark like blood. And Howard responds, and obviously, any Christian would agree with that. I'm not sure that's the case. I don't think most Christians out there I know really would. Obviously, any Christian would agree with that. He continues, I mean, what is the ultimate liquid for us? It's blood. That's what's in the chalice at the liturgy. That is our salvation. So we have this world of modernity, in the middle of which Lewis and Tolkien found themselves planted. This world that even the church would most likely, I think at first blush, maybe second, third, and fourth blush, go with the fox, 9 times out of 10. This world has lost the medieval mind altogether, a mind that looked at reality quite a bit differently than we tend to. Lewis and Tolkien both seem to want to get back to that mind, to lead us all back to a better way of thinking. One of my interns came out to join us, and I had only met him one day and chatted with him on the phone. And he comes out and he says, the headmaster of a school and his priest, he says, you know, I didn't know you very well. I didn't know you at all. So I asked, well, what kind of man is Father Foose? And they both looked at me and said, he's positively medieval. And I took that as the biggest compliment I've ever had. I mean, the medieval mind for Lewis and Tolkien was everything. In fact, you know, Lewis kind of spent his whole career becoming more medieval, almost as much as he could. And to think that that Lewis and Tolkien wanted to get back there, that's got to be the biggest oxymoron for 20th century academics. Because after all, you know, what do we call that medieval world? We call it the Dark Ages. And so this is, how could we possibly go backwards, says our culture? But yet, there's something back there that we desperately need. Lewis, you'll remember, did not actually put the whole of the medieval world together until after Tolkien had exerted a good deal of influence on him. According to Walter Hooper, Lewis's friend and biographer, a realization of the truth in mythologies triggered Lewis's conversation to Christianity. I want to quote, following up on what Bishop Sutton talked about the first day. There's a little bit more detail, so I think you might appreciate it. This is out of Lewis and the Catholic Church. This conversion to the truth in mythologies came about after a long discussion in 1931 with Tolkien and Hugo Dyson. You remember Sutton talking about this, which continued until 4 o'clock in the morning. At the end of the marathon discussion, Lewis believed that myths were real and that facts took the shine off truth, emptying truth of its glory. Now think about that for a minute. Facts tarnish truth. Facts took the shine off truth and emptied truth of its glory. This meeting between these inklings, which was to have such a revolutionary impact on Lewis's life, happened on September 19, 1931, after Lewis had invited these two to dine at his rooms. After dinner, the three men went for a long walk beside the river, discussed the nature and purpose of myth, and Lewis explained that he had always felt the power of myths, but that they were ultimately untrue, which is what most of the Christians I deal with as a lit teacher, I'm constantly having this discussion with them, that no, this stuff is not untrue, it's not factual. And Lewis and Tolkien would say that means it's probably more true. So Lewis is a great line. Lewis says, myths are untrue. As he expressed it to Tolkien, myths were lies, even though lies breathed through silver. That's a wonderful line from Lewis. But Tolkien says, no, that's wrong. You've got it all wrong. They are not lies. Tolkien resumes the discussion, arguing that myths, far from being lies, were the best way of conveying truths, which would otherwise be inexpressible. We have come from God, continued Tolkien, and inevitably the myths woven by us, though they contain error, will also reflect a splintered fragment of true life, the eternal truth that is with God. Since we are made in the image of God, and since God is the creator, part of the imageness of God in us is the gift of creativity. The creation, or more correctly, the sub-creation of stories or myths, is merely a reflection of the image of the creator in us. As such, although myths may be misguided, they may not be directly on course all the time, they steer, however shakily, towards the true harbor, whereas materialistic progress leads only to the abyss and to the power of evil. With the help of Dyson, Tolkien developed his argument to explain that the story of Christ was the true myth, a myth that works in the same way as the others, but a myth that really happened, a myth that existed in the realm of fact as well as in the realm of truth. In the same way that men unraveled the truth through the weaving of story, God revealed the truth through the weaving of history. Tolkien had shown that pagan myths were in fact God expressing himself through the minds of poets, using their images to reveal fragments of his eternal truth. Yet most astonishingly of all, Tolkien maintained that Christianity was exactly the same, except for the enormous difference that the poet who invented it was God himself, and the images he used were the real men and the actual events of history. So, as moderns, we often neglect to see, like Lewis, the reality of the myth, and Lewis had failed to see it until Tolkien pointed it out. I want to give you a quote from Madeleine L'Engle. She gave an audio introduction to her reading of A Wrinkle in Time. And she explains why this, at some level, bringing in children, which I think is helpful to this discussion, may be kind of what's going on, or at least another perspective on this. She says, "Hello, this is Madeleine L'Engle. I'm going to be reading A Wrinkle in Time to you. It's a book that almost never got published. I'd already had half a dozen books published, but this was a very different one, and nobody knew quite what it was or who it was for. And the general feeling was that it was much too hard for children." Boy, do I hear that one all the time. "Well, my kids were 7, 10, and 12 while I was writing." You know, if you're a publisher who rejected this manuscript and you hear this, you got to feel like an absolute idiot. "And at night, I'd read to my children what I'd written during the day, and they would say, 'Oh, mother, go back to the typewriter.' So I knew they could understand it. The problem is, it's not that it's too difficult for kids, but that it's too difficult for grown-ups. Too many grown-ups tend to put themselves into little rooms with windows that don't open and doors that are locked. And they want to close themselves off from any new ideas. And you're ready and open for new ideas and new things and new places and new excitement. So I hope you'll enjoy this book. I had a wonderful time writing it." And says one commentator on this, "Isn't that the truth, that it is us adults who struggle often enough to see time wrinkle and planets tilt? And because we do, we don't often feel the cool breeze at the back of the wardrobe." Tolkien says that the realm of fairy story is wide and deep and high and filled with many things. All manner of beasts and birds are found there, shoreless seas and stars uncounted, beauty that is an enchantment and an ever-present peril. That always makes fairyland is a great place. Both joy and sorrow as sharp as swords. In that realm, a man may perhaps count himself fortunate to have wandered, but its very richness and strangeness tie the tongue of the traveler who would report them." Now, did you guys read this stuff as kids? Tolkien or Lewis, or just fairy tales? If you haven't, you need to pick it up, and you have to relive your childhood. I lived most of my life in this world, and I lived also out in the middle of meadows and valleys and lakes and mountains and trees, and the other half of my life was spent stomping through those looking for centaurs around each tree and dragons at the end, you know, at the base of the mountains. And at some level, that's what we don't want to lose. And somehow becoming an adult in our culture is often a loss of that. I don't want to become too romantic. But they were onto something there at some level. The only way to report the land of faerie is apparently, to Tolkien, to tell the story of the land of faerie. To tell the stories of that land. Because a logical, dialectical approach fails to report this land. The arts are required. Fairy story is required. So circling back around to our first quote, we remember that fairy tales aren't just for little children, but someday you will be old enough to start reading fairy tales again. The problem is that we think, as moderns, that fairy tales are for children. Lewis and Tolkien both, I think, had this. It might be Lewis, sorry, I've read a lot of them. That they would say, look, fairy tales are for children in the way that old furniture is for the nursery. Might be an old chair, but it's really sturdy, really useful, so you don't put it in your dining room, you put it in the nursery where the kid's going to slobber on it anyways. Well, fairy tales are for everyone, but adults have lost the taste of it. They don't want it in the living room anymore, or the dining room, so they relegate it to the nursery. Lewis said he loves to write for children, but he says, basically, I just write for adults. It's just that children are the only one bright enough to know that this is the stuff they should be reading. They're very soft in their approach, but you get it, you know, eventually. Well, none of us are all that smart, are we? Hopefully, one of these days, we moderns will grow up enough to enjoy and understand at a much deeper level the world of fairy. So Lewis finally gets and defends the truth of myths. I'd like to read now from his essay, Myth Become Fact. Lewis argues against the modernist, Corinius, in his essay, who says that no one is really a Christian in the modern world. Now get this. Historic Christianity, quote, historic Christianity, says Corinius, is something so barbarous that no modern man can really believe it. The moderns who claim to do so aren't in fact believing a modern system of thought which retains the vocabulary of Christianity and exploits the emotions inherited from it while quietly dropping its essential doctrines. Recommend the essay if you haven't read it in a while. It's found in God in the Dock. I'm going to shorten Lewis's reply to get focus on what I need to focus on, but it's really worth a read. Lewis's short reply is, the real answer of even the most modernist Christian to Corinius is the same. Even assuming, which I must constantly deny, that the doctrines of historic Christianity are merely mythical, it is the myth which is the vital and nourishing element in the whole concern. Did you get that? I mean, I think even most Christians are going to go, huh? Read that out of context, and you're going to have people throwing stones at you. If you say C.S. Lewis, it'll save your life, but they're still not going to understand it. The doctrines of historic Christianity, he denies that they are mythical, but even assuming that they are mythical, it's the myth which is the vital and nourishing element of the whole concern. Corinius wants us to move with the times, right? Get with the times. I hear that all the time. I mean, look, I walk around my town looking like this in California. Hey, buddy, don't you know the Middle Ages are over? Yes, actually, I do, but the myth is not. Corinius wants us to move with the times, says Lewis. Now we know where times move. They move away. But in religion, we find something that does not move away. It is what Corinius calls the myth that abides. It's still here. And he's this great little section in that essay, so you've got to read that essay. But I'm going to skip it. But I'm going to let Lewis develop his argument by reading you a slightly longer passage. So now he wants to explain myth. So to explain this, we must look a little closer at myth in general and this myth of Christianity in particular. Human intellect is incurably abstract. I mean, after all, that's what in some sense separates us from the animals, right? We have this abstract reasoning capability, which is glorious and, yeah. He says, human intellect, incurably abstract, yet the only realities we experience are concrete. This pain, this pleasure, this dog, this man. While we are loving the man, bearing the pain, enjoying the pleasure, we are not intellectually apprehending pleasure, pain, or personality. When we begin to do so, on the other hand, the concrete realities sink to the level of mere instances or examples. We are no longer dealing with them, but with that which they exemplify. This is our dilemma, either to taste and not to know, or know and not to taste. Or more strictly, to lack one kind of knowledge because we are in an experience, or to lack another kind because we are outside of the experience. As thinkers, we are cut off from what we think about. As tasting, touching, willing, loving, hating, we do not clearly understand. The more lucidly we think, the more we are cut off. The more deeply we enter into reality, the less we can think. You cannot study pleasure in the moment of the nuptial embrace. Your spouse is likely to slap you. Nor repentance while repenting. Nor analyze the nature of humor while roaring with laughter. I mean, think about it. You're just guffawing. That's the last moment that you're thinking, what does laughter mean? But when else can you really know these things, asked Lewis. If only my toothache would stop, I could write another chapter about pain. But once it stops, what do I know about pain? So there's a dilemma here. Lewis talked. Now, I want to talk about poetic knowledge. And that's what Lewis, I think, is describing here without using the terminology. But poetic knowledge is the experiential knowledge. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later. Finishing up with Lewis. Of this tragic dilemma, myth is the partial solution. In the enjoyment of a great myth, we come nearest to experiencing as a concrete what can otherwise be understood only as an abstraction. So hopefully, in the arts in general, maybe, I might whisper, but he's talking about myth. These two things can start to come together. And this is part of why we have to have the arts in human culture. No matter how, honestly, decadent, empty, shallow, we still have them, don't we? There's this driving need to express ourselves and to relate to other humans in something other than having a conversation or being about something together. We want something that expresses the beyond, the mystery. Okay, so to circle back around to the answers I gave to the question, how do fairy stories help us to live the good life or to be better people? I'm going to list off those answers again and jump out if you have any ideas. If not, you'll have to listen to my mundane ones. And you have to go home thinking about it and write me later and say, well, this is a much better answer. So by helping, one of the answers was, how do fairy tales or fairy stories help us to live the good life or to be better people? One, by helping us to relate to the world the way God would have us relate. Any ideas about this?
I can maybe say something. The embrace of rationalism in the church, maybe in some sects or denominations more than others, has made it turn its back on the magic mysterium. But we don't want anything to be inscrutable. We want everything to be nailed down. And there's your clear water.
Yeah. Water. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, clear water. Thank you, because if it's blood, then it's going to be messy. I can't see anything. We're going to have like stains all over the place. And there's this unbelievable fear in modern American Christianity in general, shall I say, of mystery. Incredible fear. And I would argue almost, I mean, you name the denomination. I mean, take the sacrament of the body and blood of Jesus. I don't care whether you're Roman Catholic or you're Presbyterian or Baptist, whatever. We've managed to get rid of all mystery. I know exactly what it is. Let me tell you. I write down for you. Right? Again, we're dialectically describing stuff. I'm sorry. Impossible. Impossible. Why do you think some of the greatest music written is about the sacrament of the body and blood of Jesus? Why is the liturgy an experience and not a lecture? I mean, this is how we enter in, right? So we relate to the world. We need to see the world and in the imagination a pathway to the reality of God and what the world really is. We need to be able to open our eyes and see with new lenses, hopefully every day. Lenses that are just a little bit more sanctified, that actually believe the worldview that the Bible gives us. And we won't go into that because that's a whole other lecture. But I mean, we don't think in the categories of Scripture very much. We tend to think in the categories of modernity. So it would be helpful to read fairy tales, to be honest with you. It would be helpful in reading fairy tales to learn how to look at the world the way that God would have us look at it, honestly, because I think the ancient myths and fairy stories and tales are a lot closer to the way God would have us look at the world than modernity. And I think we would get a better perception of truth as it is, as we are to live it out and embody it in the material world of creation. Also, a more fully embodied way of living will fight against that modernist understanding of the truth, that it's all rational and that it's all what can be quantifiable, measured, laid out, repeated as experiments. And then we'll also fight against that old heresy Gnosticism, which we can't seem to shake, which has come home to roost in the church of modern America. You know, every time you embody anything, the Gnostics run screaming. So I think that's a way in which fairy tales and this view of story will help us to relate to God's creation. Second answer I gave was by helping us to understand how to know the world around us. Allow me, please, to take us on a bit of a rabbit trail, but I think this then connects with the first reading I gave. And this is from Taylor, James Taylor, not the musician. Dr. James Taylor, who, great guy, lovely man to talk with. He's the first time I met him, he goes, "Well, Father, he's kind of got some jowls and shit." "Well, I'm Roman Catholic." I said, yeah, no, I heard that. "I'm an Anglican priest." Yes. "Well, I go to the Latin Mass." "No, okay." And my eyebrows must have raised because there's some wacky Roman Catholics out in California too. And some of these guys are Latin Mass guys, and they're wacky. There's the normal Latin Mass guys too. But he says, "No, I'm not one of those weirdos." He says, "When's the last time you've?" This is James Taylor, not me. He says, "When's the last time you've been to a Roman Mass?" "Novus Ordo." "God awful ugly. Can't take it. Latin Mass, the only beauty left." So, anyways, you get a sense of his world, but just helping you to understand maybe a real quick understanding of poetic knowledge, because I think it really plays into that what we did at the beginning of this time, and what we are called to do in our worship of God, in our living out, in our reading of Holy Scripture. Not completely and only, but one way of knowing. So, here's Taylor talking about knowing. Whatever poetic knowledge is, it is not strictly speaking a knowledge of poems, but a spontaneous act of the external and internal senses with the intellect, integrated and whole, rather than an act associated with the powers of analytic reasoning. It is, according to a tradition from Homer to Robert Frost, from Socrates to Maritain, a natural human act, synthetic and penetrating, that gets us inside the thing experienced. It is, we might say, knowledge from the inside out, radically different in this regard from a knowledge about things. In other words, it is the opposite of scientific knowledge. Concerning scientific knowledge and its predominant spirit in all aspects of modern education, by the end of the 19th century, Charles Dickens gives us Professor Thomas Gradgrind as its great champion. Which is great stuff, right? So this is really, he's talking about what Lewis is talking about, right? Experiencing the myth. He's talking about what we did as we read through and listened to Oriol struggling in her own soul. I mean, did you get the depth of her own struggle? I mean, her story is about her own sin and about hopeful redemption, although she doesn't see that. Here's Gradgrind. "Now what I want is facts. Teach these boys and girls nothing but facts. Facts alone are wanted in life. Plant nothing else. You can only form the minds of reasoning animals upon facts. Nothing else will ever be of any service to them. Lewis and Tolkien would not agree with this at all, would they? From the point of view of an ancient tradition, actually from an immemorial view of the nature of the human being as knower, this position of Gradgrind's is a radically shallow idea of knowledge. Something very strange is taking place in the Western world when we keep in mind this tradition. To assist in contrasting this change, it should be recalled that in the same decade of Dickens' Hard Times, there also appeared two of the greatest scientific and materialistic statements on man, Das Kapital and The Origin of Species. How deeply Dickens understood the encroachment of the mechanistic world view of man and the universe. How profoundly modern science, adrift from the metaphysical tradition of the West, had restricted the limits of knowledge to facts. It's portrayed in the opening chapter of his book. Gradgrind is called on student number 20, because we don't need names. Now, some of us would rather have numbers because we can't remember names, no matter how many years they've been in our classroom. I just say, what's your name again? Abigail? You've known me since I was born. Sorry. So he calls on student number 20, Sissy Jupe, to tell the class something of her background. She is shy, modest, and understandably quite terrified of Gradgrind. I think we all would be. She manages to reveal that her father is a horse trainer for the local circus. I actually dreamed of running away with the circus. Anyone else do that? Thank you. And, of course, that occupation of her father is far below the standards of our enlightened Gradgrind. In an attempt to expose her ignorance, I hate teachers like this, he demands that Sissy tell the class what a horse is. That is, to give a brief, factual definition. That's what he's looking for. Just as she begins an answer, he scolds her for not having any facts about a horse. Bitzer, a boy that probably needed to be beat up, in the same class, who has clearly excelled in the Gradgrind method of knowledge, provides the correct answer. Quadruped, gramnivorous, 40 teeth, namely 24 grinders, 4 eye teeth, 12 incisive. Sheds coat in the spring. In marshy countries, sheds hoofs too. Hoofs hard, but requiring to be shod with iron. Age known by marks in mouth. Now, girl number 20, said Gradgrind, you know what a horse is. That's our world. The cruel irony is, of course, that no one in the class except Sissy knows what a horse is, least of all Gradgrind and Bitzer. This little scene at the beginning of Hard Times is offered under the theme of Chapter 1 titled The One Thing Needful. That is, the kind of knowledge that derives from the love of a thing, a person, or a place. A horse, and the loss of such knowledge and its replacement by the superficial facts demanded by a Gradgrind is precisely what has made these times hard. Harder than they should be. What is needed, Dickens says, the one thing is what Sissy could have told the class about horses. That would have been her intimate knowledge of their habits and personalities, the do's and don'ts of their care and training, and her love. Her knowledge would be something closer to the essence of horses because of her simple familiarity with their wholeness as an animal rather than Bitzer's facts, most likely memorized from a textbook. So that's poetic knowledge, excuse me. And I believe that entering into that type of relationship with great story, fantasies, fairy tales, myths, is going to help us to understand how to know the world around us, to experience it, to in some sense, vicariously experience the world through story, but then to go out and live in that world in a similar way. And that's what Lewis was talking about in Myth Become Fact, those two types of knowledge. Dr. Taylor says that never at any time is the intellect not involved in knowledge. And experience is knowledge, but it's just not the discursive approach that seeks to explain, to talk about the thing which does not involve the faculties or energies of the heart. So that love needs to be there as well, right? So this is relational knowledge. It's not just kind of knowing about stuff, but it's entering into stuff. C.S. Lewis, in his experiment on criticism, talks the same way about books. And I've extended that to argue out, like when I take my kids to the National Gallery about a month ago. We just slowed down. I said, just look. Just experience it. And after you experience for a while, then maybe we'll talk about it. Maybe what's happening and how's the artist doing this and that. But first and foremost, just experience. If I do nothing else well during a semester, or trimester for us, if I don't really get the really good discussion going about Homer's Iliad that I wanted that semester, and there's those two places I really like to pull the students to think through that more eloquently, more thoughtfully, a little bit more time, get some good discussion going. If I fail all that, at the end of the term, I just go, you know what? My kids read the Iliad. All of it. Not in the original. Pieces in the original, usually. They read the Iliad. I've succeeded. They've entered into and experienced one of the great stories of the world. And in fact, when I know I'm really successful, it's not that their papers come back with really great essays. It's that when I read out loud, as I always do every time I teach it, I get to teach it this fall. When I read out loud Achilles and, oh shoot, what's the Trojan hero? Hector. Thank you, Hector. When I read out loud Hector and Achilles' battle and Hector's death, and I look up and I've got students who are crying, then I've succeeded. Because they've entered into the text and they've experienced something beautiful. They don't have to know what it means. They can just experience something beautiful, and I've succeeded as a teacher. So this kind of knowledge is, I think, really important, and I think fairy stories can really help us in that kind of knowledge and to understand the world around us with that kind of knowledge. Mind you, be discerning about what you read. I'm not saying, you know, don't do, oh, I have students come up, Father, what about this book? I think I should just experience it. No. Cover? No. Romance fiction, girls, is just not what I'm talking about. The third answer I gave is by helping us to enter into the mysteries of creation and redemption. And I think here at some level, you know, we start to lose track of even how to talk about this stuff. With a fuller and better faculty for understanding what we're doing and experiencing Scripture, understanding story and how it functions better, just naturally, without even analyzing necessarily, with a better faculty for understanding and entering into the liturgy, we enter into the mysteries of the faith and of redemption with, in a certain sense, a better understanding of what we're doing, even though that understanding may not be dialectical or, you know, that sort. Can we talk and make an argument about the body and blood of Christ and what it is and baptism? Absolutely. But if we think that's all there is to know about it, then I think we're sadly mistaken. We have to experience it. And remember that in the ancient church, catechesis about the sacraments did not start. They didn't mention anything about it until after they had experienced baptism, confirmation, Holy Communion, which all happened, you know, on Easter Eve. And then they started to explain as much as can be explained, that experience, that knowledge by experience that they had gleaned.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Hopefully it's not completely off topic. But was that kind of the why in the prayer book they don't use the word change, maybe like they do in, I think, Roman Catholic liturgy, and when they're talking about the
elements?
Yeah. That's
It's probably connected, but maybe we should talk, you know, over dinner or something, a little bit more. We come to the sacraments knowing that the kind of knowing our world talks about is not as important as we once thought. We don't have to have everything answered, all our I's dotted and T's crossed, before we can participate in the mysteries of the church. And I always really feel sorry for those people that feel like they have to really fully understand something before they can participate, because I'd be sitting outside church. I'd be sitting outside the church. I don't have any idea at one level of what's going on. And yet at some other level, I glory in my understanding of what's going on. But I can't even explain what the glory means. I can't even explain why I do it half the time. I think we come to creation in the same way. We can and should be more open to the experience of God's creation. No, I'm not a romantic tree hugger, although I like the romantic poets at some level. They're some of the best lyrical poets ever produced in the English language. But we should be able to experience God's creation. Remember, I grew up tripsing through the woods. I would go to the river not to fish, but I would bring my novel or whatever with me. I'd sit on a rock by the river and read for a couple of hours. So I know I'm strange. But we come to a meal with friends. We come to the marriage bed. We come to a rainy day on the mountains. We come to all of it with eyes more open when we've read deeply from the land of fairy. We come with eyes wide open in wonder, awaiting what God will show us of himself in the world around us. And I think that's a much healthier way to live than much of what goes on in our world today. So I think those, if I can submit those as some reasons that we all ought to be reading fairy tales, then I do. Any questions, thoughts, comments, clarifications on your part of what I said, that'd be helpful. Yeah.
Another sort of take on this is a short article by Ursula Le Guin entitled, "Why Are Americans Afraid of Dragons?"
That sounds interesting. I'll have to look that up. "Why Are Americans Afraid of Dragons?" by Ursula Le Guin. Haven't read her in a long time. Any other thoughts, questions?